After an hour, we moved down to the gate. We were still early, and it was almost deserted. Just a few transit passengers, all shopped out, or broke like us. We sat far away from them and stared into space.
"Feels bad going back,"
Summer said.
"You can forget how much trouble you're in when you're away."
"All we need is a result," I said.
"We're not gonna get one. It's been 10 days and we're nowhere."
I nodded. 10 days since Mrs. Kramer died, 6 days since Carbone died, 5 days since Delta had given me a week to clear my name.
"We've got nothing," Summer said. "Not even the easy stuff. We didn't even find the woman from Kramer's motel. That shouldn't have been difficult."
I nodded again. She was right. That shouldn't have been difficult. The gate filled with travelers, and we boarded 40 minutes before takeoff. Summer and I had seats behind an old couple in an exit row. I wished we could change places with them. I would have been glad of the extra room. We took off on time, and I spent the first hour getting more and more cramped and uncomfortable. The stewardess served a meal that I couldn't have eaten even if I'd wanted to, because I didn't have enough room to move my elbows and operate the silverware. One thought led to another. I thought about Joe flying in the night before. He would have flown coach. That was clear. A civil servant on a personal trip doesn't fly any other way. He would have been cramped and uncomfortable all night long, a little more than me because he was an inch taller. So I felt bad all over again about putting him in the bus to town. I recalled the hard plastic seats and his cramped position and the way his head was jerked around by the motion. I should have sprung for a cab from the city and kept it waiting at the curb. I should have found a way to scare up some cash. One thought led to another. I pictured Kramer and Vassal and Coomer flying in from Frankfurt on New Year's Eve. American Airlines, a Boeing jet. No more spacious than any other jet. An early start from 12 Corps, a long flight to Dulles. I pictured them walking down the jetway, stiff, airless, dehydrated, uncomfortable. One thought led to another. I pulled the George Sank bill out of my pocket, opened the envelope, read it through again, examined every line and every item. The hotel bill, the airplane, the bus to town. The bus to town, the airplane, the hotel bill. I closed my eyes. I thought about things that Sanchez and the Delta adjutant and Detective Clark and Andrea Norton and Summer herself had said to me. I thought about the crowd of meeters and greeters we'd seen in the Roissy Charles de Gaulle arrivals hall. I thought about Sperryville, Virginia. I thought about Mrs. Kramer's house in Green Valley. In the end, dominoes fell all over the place and landed in ways that made nobody look very good. Least of all me, because I'd made many mistakes, including the big one that I knew for sure was going to come right back and bite me in the ass. I kept myself so busy pondering my prior mistakes that I let my preoccupation lead me into making another one. I spent all my time thinking about the past, and no time at all thinking about the future, about countermeasures, about what would be waiting for us at Dulles. We touched down at 2 a.m. and came out through the customs hall and landed straight in a trap set by Willard. Standing in the same place they'd stood 6 days earlier, with the same 3 warrant officers from the Provost Marshal General's office. 2 W-3s and a W-4. I saw them, they saw us. I spent a second wondering how the hell Willard had done it. Did he have guys standing by at every airport in the country all day and all night? Did he have a Europe-wide trace out on our travel vouchers? Could he do that himself? Or was the FBI involved? The Department of the Army? The State Department? Interpol? NATO? I had no idea. I made an absurd mental note that one day I should try to find out. Then I spent another second deciding what to do about the situation. Delay was not an option. Not now. Not in Willard's hands. I needed freedom of movement and freedom of action for 24 or 48 more hours. Then I would go see Willard. I'd go see him happily, because at that point I would be ready to slap him around and arrest him. The W-4 walked up to us with his W-3s at his back. "I have orders to place you both in handcuffs," he said. "Ignore your orders," I said. "I can't," he said. "Try." "I can't," he said again. I nodded. "Okay, we'll trade," I said. "You try it with the handcuffs, I'll break your arms. You walk us to the car, we'll go quietly." He thought about it. He was armed. So were his guys. We weren't. But nobody wants to shoot people in the middle of an airport. Not unarmed people from your own unit. That would lead to a bad conscience. And paperwork. And he didn't want a fist fight. Not three against two. I was too big and Summer was too small to make it fair. "Deal?" he said. "Deal," I lied. "So let's go." Last time he'd walked ahead of me and his hot dog W-3s had stayed on my shoulders. I sincerely hoped he would repeat that pattern. I guessed the W-3s figured themselves for real badass sons of bitches, and I guess they were close to being correct. But it was a W-4 I was most worried about. He looked like the genuine article. But he didn't have eyes in the back of his head, so I hoped he would walk in front. He did. Summer and I stayed side by side with our bags in our hands, and the W-3s formed up wide and behind us in an arrowhead pattern. The W-4 led the way. We went out through the doors into the cold, turned towards the restricted lane where they'd parked last time. It was past 2 in the morning, and the airport approach roads were completely deserted. There were lonely pools of yellow light from fixtures up on posts. It had been raining. The ground was wet. We crossed the public pickup lane and crossed the median where the bus shelters were. We headed onward into the dark. I could see the bulk of a parking garage half left and the green Chevy Caprice far away to the right. We turned towards it, walked in the roadway. Most other times of the day we would have been mown down by traffic, but right then the whole place was still and silent. Past 2 o'clock in the morning. I dropped my bag and used both hands and shoved Summer out of the way, stopped dead and jerked my right elbow backward and smashed the right-hand W-3 hard in the face, kept my feet planted and twisted the other way like a violent calisthenic exercise and smacked the left-hand W-3 with my left elbow. Then I stepped forward and met the W-4 as he spun towards the noise and came in for me. I hit him with a straight left to the chest. His weight was moving, and my weight was moving, and the blow messed him up pretty good. I followed it with a right hook to his chin and put him on the ground. Turned back to the W-3s to check how they were doing. They were both down on their backs. There was some blood on their faces. Broken noses, loosened teeth. A lot of shock and surprise. An excellent stun factor. I was pleased. They were good, and I was better. I checked the W-4. He wasn't doing much. I squatted down next to the W-3s and took their Berettas out of their holsters. Then I twisted away and took the W-4s out of his. Threaded all three guns on my forefinger. Then I used my other hand to find the car keys. The right-hand W-3 had them in his pocket. I took them out and tossed them to Summer. She was back on her feet. She was looking a little dismayed. I gave her the three Berettas, and I dragged the W-4 by his collar to the nearest bus shelter. Then I went back for the W-3s and dragged them over, one in each hand. I got them all lined up face down on the floor. They were conscious, but they were groggy. Heavy blows to the head are a lot more consequential in real life than they are in the movies. and I was breathing hard myself, almost panting. The adrenaline was kicking in, some kind of delayed reaction. Fighting has an effect on both parties to the deal. I crouched down next to the W-4. "I apologize, Chief," I said, "but you got in the way." He said nothing, just stared up at me. Anger, shock, wounded pride, confusion. "Now listen," I said, "listen carefully. You never saw us. We weren't here. We never came. You waited for hours, but we didn't show. You came back out and some thief had boosted your car in the night. That's what happened, okay?" He tried to say something, but the words wouldn't come out right. "Yes, I know," I said. "It's pretty weak and it makes you look real stupid. But how good does it make you look that you let us escape? That you didn't handcuff us like you were ordered to?" He said nothing. "That's your story," I said. "We didn't show, and your car was stolen. Stick to it, or I'll put it about that it was the lieutenant who took you down. A 90-pound girl, 1 against 3. Oh, people will love that. They'll go nuts for it. And you know how rumors can follow you around forever." He said nothing. "Your choice," I said. He shrugged. Said nothing. "I apologize," I said. "Sincerely." We left them there and grabbed our bags and ran to their car. Summer unlocked it and we slid in and she fired it up, put it in gear and moved away from the curb. "Go slow," I said. I waited until we were alongside the bus shelter and then wound the window down and tossed the Berettas out on the sidewalk. Their cover story wouldn't hold up if they lost their weapons as well as their car. The three guns landed near the three guys, and they all got up on their hands and knees and started to crawl towards them. "Now go," I said. Summer hit the gas hard and the tires lit up, and about a second later we were well outside handgun range. She kept her foot down, and we left the airport doing about 90 miles an hour. "You okay?" I said.
"So far," she said.
"Sorry I had to shove you."
"We should have just run," she said. "We could have lost them in the terminal."
"We needed a car," I said. "I'm sick of taking the bus."
"But now we're way out of line."
"That's for sure," I said. I checked my watch. It was close to 3 in the morning. We were heading south from Dulles, going nowhere, fast, in the dark. We needed a destination. "You know my phone number at Bird?" I said.
"Sure,"
Summer said. "Okay, pull over at the next place with a phone." She spotted an all-night gas station about 5 miles later. It was all lit up on the horizon. We pulled in and checked it out. There was a miniature grocery store behind the pumps, but it was closed. At night, you had to pay for your gas through a bulletproof window. There was a payphone outside next to the air hose. It was an aluminum box mounted on the wall. The box had phone shapes drilled into the sides. Summer dialed my Fort Byrd office number and handed me the receiver. I heard one cycle a ringtone, and then my sergeant answered. The night duty woman, the one with the baby son. "This is Reacher," I said.
"You're in deep shit," she said.
"Yeah, and that's the good news," I said.
"What's the bad news?"
"You're gonna join me right there in it. What kind of babysitting arrangements have you got?"
"My neighbor's girl stays, from the trailer next door."
"Could she stay an hour longer?"
"Why?"
"I want you to meet me. I want you to bring me some stuff."
"It'll cost you."
"How much?"
$2 an hour for the babysitter."
"I haven't got $2. That's something I want you to bring. Money."
"You want me to give you money?"
"Alone," I said. "A couple of days."
"How much?"
"Whatever you got."
"When and where?"
"When you get off, at 6. At the diner near the strip club."
"What do you need me to bring?"
"Phone records," I said. "All calls made out of Fort Byrd, starting from midnight on New Year's Eve until maybe the 3rd of January. And an Army phone book. I need to speak to Sanchez and Franz and all kinds of other people. And I need Major Marshall's personal file. The 12 Corps guy. I need you to get a copy faxed in from somewhere."
"Anything else?"
"I want to know where Vassal and Coomer parked their car when they came down for dinner on the 4th. I want you to see if anyone noticed."
"Okay," she said. "Is that it?"
"No," I said. I want to know where Major Marshall was on the second and the third. Scare up some travel clerk somewhere and see if any vouchers were issued. And I want a phone number for the Jefferson Hotel in D.C.
That's an awful lot to do in 3 hours.
That's why I'm asking you instead of the day guy. You're better than he is.
Stick it, she said. Flattery doesn't work on me.
Hope springs eternal, I said.